WEPR, United Workers and Poverty Radio.
Hello, everyone. In this segment, you'll be hearing from United Workers Leadership Organizer Luis Larin and Michael Fox. Unite Here Local 7 Organizer Tracy Lingo and Keepers of the Mountains Director Elise Keaton. They spoke about organizing across urban and rural communities. The event took place at Towson University on April 8th and was recorded by the United Workers media team.
Hello, everyone. My name is Luis Larin. I'm a leadership organizer with the United Workers. So that's one of the campaigns, projects that we are working on under the Fair Development Campaign, which is the most recent campaign that United Workers has been working on in collaboration with Unite Here and for Worker Justice and other organizations around Baltimore. And this is a kind of like a following of United Workers history, where we started organizing workers at the stadium in Camden Yards back in 2002. And, you know, this is pretty much the same principle. These public spaces that are receiving a lot of public resources and yet are exploiting workers, have not been beneficial for our communities, and pretty much are hurting our communities instead. Lifting people out of poverty, or keeping people in poverty. When we started the stadium, for example, most of the people there were homeless, and yet they were working, which is ironic because most of the time people associate homelessness with laziness or people don't want to work, when the reality is very different. We experiment. We saw so many low-wage workers that are homeless. Or maybe not in the way that most people think about homelessness, but when you are going from friend to friend or family members to family members' houses, you're pretty much homeless. Mm-hmm. But people don't see it like that, don't think like that. I'm sure Tracy will talk a little bit more about like the experience that they have with other places that workers are confronting the same problem with of poverty, wages, and exploitation, which was one of the things that we had at the stadium. When I met United Workers back in 2006, the United Workers was already full into the campaign of for living wages for the stadium, and I was one of those day laborers working at the stadium, and that was how I get involved, because, you know, like after you work days of 10-hour shift and you get a payment for $20, you've really see like why I'm doing this, like why I'm working so hard and getting less than the minimum wage under a lot of excuses and a lot of like hidden fees and, you know, ways that the employer was looking for exploit workers more. And after we won the campaign at the Camden Yards, from workers making $4 per hour to make the living wage that is $10.25, if I'm right. I'm not sure if it's still 2025 or more because it's going up with the inflation. So, but that was back in 2007 when we won that campaign, where we, you know, finally get for workers a living wage. Then we started to work at the Inner Harbor. We started organizing restaurant workers and cleaning workers, and it was under the same principle of this is another place that Baltimore feel proud of, and Baltimore. Actually promote himself, promote around the country as, look how successful the Inner Harbor is. We are doing this partnership, this private-public partnership. We dump some money there to private developers, and everything looks beautiful, and everything is very well taken care of, and we can feel proud of Baltimore. And, you know, we have hotels, we have, like, really top hotels, top restaurant chains, and all of those things. And it's being used as a good example of development. However, that's not what we don't believe that, because we saw, we talked to workers, we organized the workers, and we know that that's not, that isn't, that development is not working for the community. It's actually failed development, and what we are looking for is for failed development that really benefit the communities and that really give the communities something that they deserve. We're working under the principles of universality and equity, that where everyone receive what they deserve and that everyone can meet their needs and not just developers. One quick example of that was David Cordish has been paying $1,000 per year in rent to the city for the whole building where is the biggest restaurants as Hard Rock Cafe, Philips, and before there were the ESPN Sun, and the ESPN Sun shut down their doors. That was a national level, but they violate a federal law when they did that, and we organized the workers for 3 years to stay in a lawsuit against Disney, since Disney is the owner of ESPN Sun, and we successfully won the case, but after 3 years, and it was really hard, you know, because the case, Walt Disney literally spent probably 10 times what the case was worth it, paying their lawyers, instead of just come to the table and do what was fair for the workers. And that's just a tiny little example of how this is not working for our communities and it's not and it's failed development. And from there, we also start to see like the communities have been affected in other ways, more than the job perspective. People living in these communities are living in poverty. Empty houses, vacant houses is the biggest problem in Baltimore City when you talk about housing. And yet, you know, we have 40,000 empty houses and we have 4,000 people that are homeless. So that doesn't make any sense, right? If you have we have more than enough to get everyone with a house. But that's not the case. So we started to work on that and the housing project too as another way to see development, because right now most of the development programs are very, very well structured to support developers, private developers with public resources. And for us, that's the problem, because at the end of the day, that just hurt our communities. For example, when the mayor is talking about 10,000 new families. We welcome in 10,000 new families, but we also need to take care of the people that we have here, because the problem is that every time that those developments come up, people that have been living there, the old residents, they get pushed out of their communities, and where they go, and so that's for us that's the problem. The problem is not that we have 10,000 new families. The problem is that what we'll do with all the families that we have already here that are living in poverty. So that's, you know, that's a pretty much the first development campaign that they've decided we're working that we are working on, and Tracy will share a little bit more of like from the union perspective of what they have been working on. But before I pass that, very quick, we also have been working on the Healthcare is a Human Right campaign, which is a little bit more broad, and it's not just it's not just in Baltimore City. It's a statewide effort that we are doing, and it is really interesting to go to this very conservative counties, and yet they're saying yes, healthcare should be a human right. You know, it is not a question when we see like how the system is over and over failing to people to provide basic needs as healthcare, right? Like when people need to go. People going bankruptcy because they can't pay for hospital bills. It's just insane. When people are homeless because they can't pay for the bills, and people that we are talking to that say, you know, I declare myself in bankruptcy, and now I cannot. I it's better for me to be not working, because if I start to work, then I cannot get cover for the treatment that I need, and if I don't get that treatment, then I will just die. And so it's ridiculous that people need to make those decisions. And it's really, it's just absurd. We cannot accept that. And for us, it's really important to make those connections and really think about like the urban area and the rural areas. At the very end of the day, we have people. There is just human beings that we are talking about. We are talking about like getting better lives for everyone and for really think about like human rights and in the United States, to think about a better quality of life in the United States, and not just as individuals, but as a society, as a community, which is one of the things that we see more and more that is missing. And that's why for us it's really important to do this organizing and talk about leadership development and to have more people involved that can stay after the campaigns, that are not just here for one campaign, but that can really see the future as we can change this and we can have something different. So that's really brief what the United Workers have been doing, and I'll pass to Tracy now.
Okay. So Mike's going to show. So we've been really excited to work really close. My name's Tracy Lingo, and I work for Unite Here Local 7. We're the hotel food casino workers union. And we are really excited to work really closely with United Workers, and also really see ourselves in the tradition of movement unionism, which I'll talk about in a minute. But for that reason, we feel like it's really important, like Luis said, to really make connections between all of the aspects of workers' lives. And I think also, you know, I was just thinking as Luis was talking, like a lot of time, hopefully you have good history teachers here, so hopefully you don't get this. But I think a lot of times, at least when I was in high school growing up, the history you get is, you know, about really erases the real gains that people's struggles, whether they're union struggles or community struggles, have made. You know, we learn about the 8-hour workday, or, you know, having a weekend, or child labor laws, as if those were things that were passed by Roosevelt, right? But that's not what happened. Those things were all things that workers were fighting for. You know, and the same, like, on the civil rights movement, those were, you know, all kinds of human rights struggles were things that people fought for, and the fact that we had laws that put that into place really happened as a reaction to those fights, not first. So I think that's, from our perspective, that's kind of how we approach all of our work, and been really excited for, I guess, we're coming up on a year. About the last year, we've worked really closely with United Workers on a fair development campaign, really kind of calling into question the whole economic model that Baltimore is using for development, which is, you know, basically, if you think about it, a very kind of Reagan trickle-down economic, like, if you give money to the rich people at the top, that will somehow filter down to everybody. And I think, as Luis was saying, all you have to do is walk around Baltimore to realize that's not working. So last April, the city was in the midst of, you know, giving away permits and also money to the new casino that's going to get built downtown. And, you know, my union works a lot organizing casino workers. We are the largest local of our unions in Las Vegas. There's about 50,000 members there. And, you know, we know that those jobs, obviously, casinos make a ton of money. In fact, you know, housekeepers in Las Vegas make $90,000 a year. They can, like, actually buy a house, send their kids to college, because we fought for that. You know, because people fought really hard for that to be true. But we also know that, you know, Caesars, which was coming in to build this casino, was not promising to pay housekeepers in Baltimore $90,000 a year, and in fact was not promising even to let people organize, even really to obey the law and let people organize, and also was not, there had been a community fund that had been established, but they were not actually letting the community have a voice in how, there was supposed to be a fund for the casino to give money back to the communities that were going to be affected by the building of the casino. And so we had a fight about that, like, how is this actually going to benefit our communities if we're going to give all this money? So this is the video of that day. Do you have any other, want to add anything, or that's kind of?
That's pretty much it. I mean, okay. I think you kind of get the sense from this video, you'll see it in a second, but just to tag back to this thing of unity, right, and building these broader coalitions, broader movements, which I think is really, really key. And it's, you know, like Tracy said, it's something we've been doing a lot with Unite Here, but also with several different organizations. For this day, tons of different groups kind of came out, and I feel like you kind of get the sense of that. So.
Yeah, great. So let's see. I guess it's just an ending and finishing that. I should say part of that march was about the casino. Part of it was the workers at Hyatt, which is another example, downtown, which is another really good example of the city's failed development policies. In 1979, this is one campaign ago, so I have to go back and remember all my statistics that I've forgotten. But in 1979, the city of Baltimore gave Hyatt, which is owned by the Pritzker family, which is one of the richest families in the country, I think it was an $82 million loan that they could pay back over over 30 years for that for the property in the Inner Harbor. I don't know if people have been to in downtown Baltimore, the Hyatt's right there in the Inner Harbor, kind of prime real estate. And the Inner Harbor was kind of the Hyatt was sort of the crown jewel of that Inner Harbor redevelopment project. And at the time, the justification of that was really about the fact that Baltimore has a long history of being a really industrial town. And for a long time in the, I guess from about the 1940s until about the 70s, it was really a thriving economy. Like all of those houses that are now boarded were really full of people. And those the jobs that buoyed that kind of an economy were mostly the steel mills and the auto factories. And then that in turn created a bunch of other jobs, right? Like so at one point, the steel mill at Sparrows Point was the largest steel mill in the entire country, employed at its height about 80,000 people working in that one plant. And if you think about it, if those folks were in the 1970s, people were getting paid, upwards of $20 an hour in the 1970s to do those jobs, those kind of factory jobs. And the fact that people had those jobs then meant that they could go home and they could shop at the grocery store, and then there was, people could have corner grocery stores. People could have, laundries that they ran. People could have restaurants that people would go to, and because there was that money that was coming back into the community. And, what happened in the 1970s is a lot of those jobs went overseas, and if we listen again to the sort of typical mainstream, what you might hear in the news or what you might read in your high school textbook, that's sort of the end of the story. Like, what happened there is good jobs went overseas. Nobody was really at fault. It's just the way the world is, and that's too bad. And the fact that our jobs are crappy now is also no one's fault. And in reality, what happened is that was companies who faced with a working class in the U.S. who had become very, very, very organized. At the height of the American labor movement, which was about in the 1950s, one in four people in this country was a member of a union. And today that number is about, less than one in 10 if you look at the private sector. And that mattered not just for those union workers, but for everybody. And I think that's also a real kind of misconception that has been kind of out there about unions is a lot of times what people think about when they think about unions is, oh, the unions are fighting for, airline pilots to have really high salaries, or this group of workers by themselves to have really good salaries. But in reality, if you look at our real history, what happened was when 25% of the country had a union, it lifted everybody up. Even people who didn't have unions, other employers had to pay wages that were competitive with those wages in order to be able to attract employees. And it also did mean that all kinds of businesses that weren't unions, small mom-and-pop places, had the money. People were patronizing those stores and able to keep them afloat. And so, a big part of the work that we do is to that's, I think, a lot of times, it's actually really interesting, because one of the things that makes me really angry is a lot of times workers get blamed and about being poor, and there's sort of this, when all of those industrial jobs left, what kind of jobs were left here in the U.S. for everybody who's here? Like, what kind of jobs are... Okay, so who here has held a job before? Okay, what kind of jobs have you guys worked? Yeah? Quiznos. You just yell it out. You don't know. Yeah.
Server.
Oh, you guys are UFCW. Oh, actually, I think you guys are UFCW. You might be 27 or you might be 400. 27, yeah. That's a union job at least. But other jobs? Quiznos, servers, Kmart, retail. And so by and large, what are those? One more? Daycare? Okay, yeah, that's actually a really good example too. So all of those jobs are in the service part of the economy, right? In different ways. And what kind of wages do those jobs pay?
$8.
If you're a server, $8 is lucky, right? Some servers get paid $3.63. Right. Right. But, I mean, a lot of people who make 363, some days you get tips, some days you don't. If you work at TGI Fridays, your tips aren't that awesome, right? And anybody have health care at their job? What, you, the union job? Right. Anybody else have health care at their job? No. Anybody have a pension? What, you do?
Yeah.
What kind of job do you have?
I work for
Oyster. Oh, okay, great. So a few jobs. But so that's, I mean, and what happens is people get told, well, you shouldn't work in the service industry, right? Like, it's your fault. Well, you should get a better job. You shouldn't work at Quiznos your whole life, right? But the fact is, those are the jobs that are available. And I think the piece of the story that that misses is those factors, and well, the other piece of that is, you know, those jobs, like when we were organizing at the Hyatt, there's a lot of young people and a lot of people of color and a lot of women who have those jobs. Right now, this poster that I have is from BWI Thurgood Marshall Airport. And most of the folks who work there are really your age. They're, you know, 18 to 24-year-olds. Some folks who are older, but a lot of people who are trying to go to school, trying to support families even though they're young. And I think the piece of the history that story about the jobs, the industrial jobs leaving, and no, it's just really too bad that service jobs don't pay well, what that misses is those factory jobs were not good jobs either. They were terrible jobs. People worked, you know, 7 days a week. I mean, you can tell some of that story. People worked 7 days a week for almost no wages, didn't have health care, had very little safety. And what made those jobs, and mostly those jobs were looked at, and people would say, like, we don't need those jobs to be better because it's only the immigrants that work those jobs, only black people that work those jobs. Women weren't even allowed to work those jobs mostly. And that was sort of the excuse for those being bad jobs. And what made them good jobs was not that the companies decided, oh, wow, we should really give people the weekend, or, oh, wow, we really should pay people well enough that they can survive. What made those good jobs was that people got together and fought. And that's, you know, I think what's happened in the U.S. is that that's not usually what you hear about when you hear people talk about unions. Most of what you hear about is, and I think this is partially an attack from companies and partially that unions haven't done a very good job of looking, have kind of accepted that view of themselves in a way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, unions kind of get looked at as like a insurance policy, right? That we're here to protect the workers who are only in the union. And there's kind of two schools of what thought about what a union should be. I would call that business unionism. You know, but for my union, we think of ourselves as being in the tradition, as which has also been a really vibrant tradition in the U.S. of social movement unionism, which says what unions do, unions are the fighting arm, the organized fighting arm of the working class, and our job is to fight for all workers for there to be better jobs and better working conditions. And, you know, what we've really seen in this country, like, there's been a lot of talk recently about how much inequality has grown. And if you look at graphs, you can really tell as the union density, like the number of workers in unions in the U.S. went down, that graph of inequality went up, 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 up. Because companies are always going to be pushing how much can they take from the working class, and our job is to push back. And if we're not organized, we can't push back. So that's from our side, our perspective is, you know, we want to involve people in really fighting for themselves. So we actually won that fight at the Hyatt, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit today about a fight that's going on at BWI Thurgood Marshall Airport. So it's kind of, I think it's also kind of an interesting story about what's going on in the country in terms of jobs. So, you know, you would think working at an airport would be a pretty good job, right? Like, you're working at a state-owned airport. And, you know, our airport happens to be named after Thurgood Marshall, first African-American Chief Justice of the Justice of the Supreme Court, and who really brought the Brown versus Board of Education case, argued it before the Supreme Court, spent his whole life fighting for equality. And what's happened is that we've gotten to a place at BWI Airport where there's very great inequality. So the jobs, the food and retail jobs at the airport have been subcontracted out, which is another thing that has been happening in our economy as a whole, as a way for employers to have less and less responsibility for the workers that really create the wealth for them. So like at the Hyatt, there was a group of workers who worked for Hyatt, And then the lowest paid group of workers were immigrant housekeepers who worked for a subcontractor. And even though they came to work, some of them for more than 10 years for Hyatt, they were paid less to do exactly the same work. And that's sort of what's happening to workers at the airport right now, because right now subcontracted workers who work for Quiznos, for Chipotle, for McDonald's, for Silver Diner, at the airport, their median wage is $8.50 an hour. Most people don't have sick days. Most people don't have health insurance. Almost no one has any kind of retirement plans. Meanwhile, people who work for the state in the same airport, their average wage is $13.50 an hour. And so $13.45. So we have really started this fight. We've, built organized underground at first because companies are so hostile to people organizing. And workers, are worried about if the company knows they're organizing, the company might fire them, even though that's illegal. It does happen, and we have to be ready to fight back against that. And so, instead of succumbing to that fear, what we do is say, look, we need to get the strongest people together and decide that we're going to fight, because if we fight together, we're going to be able to win. And so we built underground, built a leadership committee. These are the folks on the leadership committee at the airport now. And started fighting the airport. And I think the other piece that I wanted to talk about is, it's sort of one thing to say we're stronger together, but one of the things that we've really learned in our union, and I think United Workers thinks about this too, is that you also have to be smart and strategic. And so we spend a lot of time thinking about, trying to think like the boss, like thinking about what do the decision makers, right, really want here. And so a lot of times, like with Hyatt or in the case of the airport, Martin O'Malley, who's the governor of the state, is responsible for the airport. He, wants to run for president. He wants to say he's a liberal person. He wants to say he's supporting equality. He just, fought to pass the minimum wage raise that just happened, which is good, but is very small and incremental. And so part of what we've been saying is really using our stories, and which I think both is a tactic that both United Workers and we really believe in, is getting people prepared and helping people find really public stages to really tell their own stories and, really present the fact that there is inequality and that it isn't an accident and that it can actually be fixed. So we have just spent a bunch of the last 3 months really being in Annapolis, in the state capital, and going to legislators and talking about the inequality that's happening at the airport, and getting that on the news, getting that on the radio, getting it in the newspaper, and really, really pushing and calling on the state of Maryland to take responsibility for making sure there's equality at the airport. So just like we won at the Hyatt, when workers stood up and fought and put that message out there, I believe that we'll be able to win at the airport. And so that's a fight that's in progress. Just a quick pitch, which is I brought more copies of this in the back, but there's also a sign-up sheet if you want it. We're going to have our next big action is going to be at BWI Airport. We're going to do a big picket line on May 22nd. So if people are interested in coming, or if you just want to be on our email list, feel free to sign up in the back. There's a sign-up sheet back by Santiago, and we'll make sure that you get updates.
I want to come. Can come back up for the May 2nd. Great. Job. Great work. This is all really, really good work to hear that's happening. Now, I'm going to step back in time and give a little bit of history about unionization in the coal fields in southern West Virginia. And I think the word to frame that precisely is hostility. Mm-hmm. So thank you for putting that out there. Again, my name is Elise Keaton. I'm the executive director of the Keeper of the Mountains Foundation. We were formed by a man named Larry Gibson, who worked with his family to protect land, as Nikki said, from mountaintop removal strip mining. But where that land is very historically relevant for unionization. It's the Cabin Creek, Paint Creek valleys. Folks know very little about the mine wars and the union wars that happened there back in the early 1900s because, quite frankly, one of our governors in West Virginia asked the president to write it out of our history, and the president agreed. So in many catalogs of history, the Miners' March is, if it's included, it's watered down tremendously. Here's a little bit about what happened. UMWA, the United Mine Workers Association, the union for the miners, really got a foothold in about 1890. And from 1890 until 1910, the union or the coal companies did everything they could to keep the union from actually gaining ground and gaining strength. And they used Baldwin Felt's agents, private detectives, as an enforcement arm of the coal companies. Well, those Baldwin Felt's agents turned into what is now the West Virginia State Police Department. So when you think about context, you have to understand where our state police force came from. They came from the enforcement arm of the coal companies back in the early 1900s. Well, in 1912, the miners in Cabin Creek and Paint Creek struck. They went on strike. And they camped out in that valley for about 18 months. And of their demands, I bought a good history book here called Life, Work, and Rebellion in the Coalfields, because they articulated seven demands, the reasons they struck. And if you listen to the order of their demands, it tells you a little bit about what they were dealing with. And someone, the man who actually wrote this book, said that these demands were not an irrational uprising. They were demands to be treated like human beings. Number one was recognition of the union. Number two was abolition of the mine guard system. That was the Baldwin Felt's agents that harassed people and terrorized people. And if they found out you were trying to unionize, they would beat you up. You weren't allowed to talk over the fence to your neighbor about unionization or you'd lose your mining job. I mean, it was a really aggressive anti-union campaign. Reform in the docking system. If you mined coal all day in your wagon and you came out and you had a piece of shale in it, the weight man said you didn't get paid for that whole wagon of coal. Mm. So that was the docking system, and they wanted that reformed because all the coal company did was take out that piece of shale and sell that wagon of coal for the full amount. They just didn't pay the worker. They wanted that check weightman represented and paid by the miners so that it was fairness when they evaluated what your work was. They wanted a trade with any store they pleased because they were paid in scrip, which wasn't real money. You could only use it at the coal company store. So they wanted cash wages. That was their sixth demand. They wanted to be paid in cash so that they could shop anywhere, which seems like a pretty reasonable request. And then their last demand was an increase in pay. And so the reason that this author highlighted those demands is because that shows you kind of the system they were under. If you came to work for a mining company and you signed a housing contract with that mining company, courts ruled that that was not a landlord-tenant agreement, that was a master-servant agreement. And that meant when you stopped working for the mine or you got sick, they had every reason to evict you and kick your family out on the street. And in fact, if they caught you unionizing or trying to unionize, they'd send the Baldwin Felt's agents in and they'd toss all your furniture out in the street and make a big deal about throwing your kids out on the street to intimidate you and keep you from unionizing. So all of that kind of culminated in 1921 when 15,000 miners marched on Blair Mountain. It's called the Battle of Blair Mountain. Very few people understand and know what it is. It was the second largest armed uprising in the United States ever, next to the Civil War. And what happened is it started out with about 4,000 miners that were marching toward Logan. And I want to read this to you because I think this tells you very accurately. This is in 1921. The place was Lenz Creek, about 10 miles south of Charleston, and the date was August 20th. For 3 days, thousands of miners descended upon that place, forming a citizens' army. Their announced intentions were to march through Logan County, hanging the county sheriff, whose name was Chafin, and blowing up the county courthouse on the way. Then on Domingo County, where they would overthrow martial law, liberate their union brothers in the county jails, and abolish the mine guard system. The miners from Boone, Raleigh, Fayette, Mingo, McDowell, and Logan counties also participated in the march destroys the assumption that this was an armed march of Kanawha County miners upon Logan. This was an uprising of the southern West Virginian miners against the coal establishment. So all of these miners get together, they march on Blair, and what happens is a gentleman makes a call to a representative and says to by the morning of September 1st, the miners had captured one half of the 25-mile ridge. These miners had been at war, and so they were very skilled. Some of them were soldiers, and so they put on a red bandana around their necks. That's where the term redneck comes from, is so they could identify themselves in the woods. That was the redneck army, and they marched very precision-driven. Colonels were leading this engagement. They captured 25 miles of the ridge and were ready to descend upon Logan and Mingo counties. So they were winning. A frantic coal operator in Logan wired a congressman from southern West Virginia telling him to contact President Harding immediately and say to him that unless he sends soldiers to Logan by midnight tonight, the town of Logan will be attacked by an army of 4,000 to 8,000 Reds and great loss of life and property sustained. There was no need. The president had already issued orders for 2,500 federal troops, 14 bombing planes, gas and percussion bombs, and machine guns to be sent to the area. The armed march and the Mingo County strike were doomed. Chafin, the sheriff, the Baldwin-Felts mine guard system, and the Southern West Virginia coal establishment were saved by the federal government. They dropped bombs on those men. They killed a couple dozen men in Southern West Virginia. Our federal government fired on residents and citizens trying to organize 100 years ago. This paradigm has not changed. They fight just as adamantly and just as viciously today. They don't do it with percussion bombs and the Air National Guard. They do it with propaganda and talking points that confuse the issues. So this is really important. A couple of topics that came up today. Healthcare is a human right. Why? I happen to believe that wholeheartedly. I believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness mean access to good health care, access to good jobs, and access to freedom from government interference in our lives. I think those are pretty basic principles. I also think that one of those principles is access to clean drinking water. Mm-hmm. I'm an American Water customer. I live in Charleston, West Virginia, and 3 months ago today, I walked in from work, poured a big glass of water out of my tap, drank it down, and got a text message saying, don't drink the water. There's a chemical in it. 3 months ago, they still cannot tell us today that our water is clean. The reason, we got to ask why. Why are 300,000 people in central West Virginia across 9 counties in a rural state of mountains which create water, why are 300,000 people in 9 counties on one municipal water source out of Charleston? That's a good question, right? When you think about it, it doesn't make any sense. The reason is their local water sources have already been contaminated, polluted, or compromised by the mining industry. And instead of addressing those issues of pollution since 1890, 1850, since they've been mining coal, they just continue to build out the public water resource into those counties. So then, when they contaminated that, those folks had no access to any clean drinking water, and we still don't. It's 2014. This is a major issue. So unionization is one of those things that you have to understand a lot of broad context to understand why it's relevant nowadays. And you have to understand, too, that the interests that are at play here, they never change. Those dynamics never change. You also have to remember that those of us who do this work, we have a value system that we uphold. The folks who are in opposition to us around these issues have a value system which they also uphold. And they're just as deeply ingrained in that value system as we are. And so when we talk about breaking these paradigms and talking about this, thinking like the bosses is a really good approach. It's strategic. You know, I lobbied in Colorado. I called myself the anti-lobbyist because I want to change the system. I'm an agent of change, I think. That's my role in this world. But I can't fix a machine unless I know how it works. So I had to get into that system. I had to learn what lobbying looked like. I had to learn what those conversations looked like so I could teach other folks how to get in there and break that down. It's just the same with organizing around labor, around union issues. You have to understand how that other side works. And you can beat them with logic every single time. We are thinking human beings. We know at the end of the day what we value, and we value clean air and clean water. Not only do we value it, we need it to live. So it should be at the very top of our values, above profits. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really what we have to get down to. So I think it's really important to understand where we come from. I think it's really important to understand that unions adapt and change. My dad was going to come and talk with me. He's who indoctrinated me about unions. He was a boilermaker, an international transient boilermaker for many years. Ironically enough, worked in the extraction industry his whole life. My union background and upbringing comes from extraction, and I fight anti-extraction on this end. However, one of the things that, you know, he dealt with constantly was them trying to co-opt him. He was union steward in his union, and he mm-hmm. took it upon himself to remind folks and teach new union members, the union is as strong as the people who make it. Mm-hmm. It's just like our government. If you bail out and don't participate, it's going to reflect that. And the people who do show up and participate take control and run with it. Unions are the same way. Unions are a body of people who come together and make it what it is. And it's only as strong as its weakest link. So that's something you have to understand, too, is when you commit to that, you're committing to uphold a set of values. And that's very important. And it's not just for one job or just for one event. And we have to keep that. At the height of the unions, you know, there were 250,000 United Mine Workers, and probably 100,000 of them lived in West Virginia, thriving communities. Granted, they were sick. They were always sick. You know, when you hear the traditional notions of the inbred hillbilly, something I've come to recently is, you know, we know that coal toxins cause birth defects. That's when they're regulated nowadays. Now in West Virginia, they cause birth defects. Well, unchecked 150 years ago, that was a lot of pollution going in the water. I've got a good hunch that all those birth defects were probably caused by coal toxins in the air and water. But the industry said inbred hillbillies. So you have to understand kind of the tactics that industry uses to pit us against each other. Mm-hmm. In West Virginia right now, this water crisis has given us an opportunity to go into these communities. We are seen as activists. We're seen as outside environmentalists who are trying to take jobs. And I challenge everybody I talk to, so I'll throw it out here. Show me one job in West Virginia that the EPA is responsible for taking. One. Just one. I have yet to have anybody come back to me with that. The reality is that we all need the same things, and that by pitting us against each other and confusing the conversation and treating us as though we're opposed to each other, that's a tactic that they use to keep us disorganized. This water crisis has given us an opportunity to organize. I'll use one example, and then I'll stop talking. We can open it up for conversation. Back in June of last year, 18 organizations joined together, and we asked the Federal Department of Interior Office of Surface Mining to intervene in our state Department of Environmental Protection. We asked through SMACRA, it's called a Section 733 petition. We said, they're not doing their job. They're not protecting the environment. We need the feds to come in and take over. On January 7th of this year, we had 200 signatures on a petition to take to D.C. and give to the OSM. And we were trying to figure out how we were going to get 500 signatures on that petition by February 27th. On February 27th, we delivered 50,000 signatures on a petition asking for federal intervention into our Department of Environmental Protection because they're not protecting our water. So that shows you that if you do this work, if you continue to do the work and organize, sometimes there's a catalyst. Sometimes there's something that comes along and you're set up and you're ready to take advantage of it. And it proves your point. It shows that you were right. And that's what's happened with us. So now we're having these meetings with the feds, regional directors of the OSM. We're getting into our communities. We're having water issue roundtables, particularly with women who have stepped up as leaders in this situation. Mm-hmm. And so we see this as an organizing opportunity. And again, we're taking off our environmental activist hats and we're putting on our neighbor hats and saying, I'm Elise from Raleigh County and I need clean water. What do you have here that we can talk about to get that resource, and how can we start making that happen? So organizing isn't just about labor issues. But when you organize within your communities, all of a sudden there's a structure there that when labor issues come about, you've got that organization and structure. And so powers in the relationship, you know, very basic organizing principles are usable across the board for a number of levels of organizing. So thank you for coming here tonight and learning about this. And I invite you, if you want to come learn a little bit about the mine wars and mine history, come to West Virginia. I'll take you. I'll show you where Mother Jones stood and talk to miners down in Paint Creek. It'll give you goosebumps, I promise. So, thanks.
Everybody in, nobody out. Everybody in, nobody out. Everybody in, nobody out.
From Baltimore, this is UWEPR, United Workers and Poverty Radio.